Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Sarah Jane Morris. This is a fantastic story, and we really go into the most unorthodox of upbringings, and I think we get to the point where Sarah was at like 13 different schools, and you know, confidence was a real low, and then to turn that round, and then you know, to have, I think it was like that when she was in the Communards, four or eight weeks, I think it was at number one with Don't Leave Me This Way. And the impact that that has on you, you know, to become this super recognisable face literally overnight, and we talk about the work that has followed that, and her career in Italy, and a beautiful story about the loyalty of those Italian fans, a recent trip to South Africa, and we talk at length about the project that she's been working on that started kind of in lockdown and has come up to this point ahead of a show on October the 6th. And it's a long chat, this one as well. I think we went for about 90 minutes, and we could have gone on for double that because her life's fascinating, and stories about incredible artists, and yeah, I can't wait for you to hear it. But before we get on with it, a few thank yous. So I want to thank Scroobius Pip, everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network, which this podcast is proud to be part of. Big thanks to the team at the Blue Murder Club podcast who produced this podcast. And that podcast, go check it out if you like your true crime. Blue Murder Club, go give that a listen. If it's your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then hello. You've missed loads. Well over 500 episodes now. So when you finish this chat with Sarah, why not go and explore the back catalogue? Because well, there's a real who's who of fascinating guests that have all been on talking about their favourite records and their stories. And from huge rock bands like the Foo Fighters and the Killers and Motley Crue through to fantastic actors like David Duchovny, Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoos, through to fantastic indie bands like the Kaiser Chiefs, the Kooks, oh God, who else have I done? Fatboy Slim, Public Enemy. Oh, the list is endless. Comedians like Acaster and Ed Gamble. Oh, blimey. I'll tell you what, I could be here all day. So the best thing to do is when you listen, when you get to the end of this episode, go and check out that back catalogue. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts, and they're all free. So go get stuck in. I'm going to tell you quickly about my Patreon. That's the bit where you get to support the podcast over there, and it's a dollar. It's about 70p a month, and that gets you access to loads of back catalogue content, hundreds of radio shows, hundreds of episodes, weekly playlists and mixtapes, a monthly live show where you get a chance to be on the podcast as well. You get to come and join this amazing chat over on Zoom where a lovely little gang of us all get together and we just pick a little topic and we have a lovely little chat, and we release that as well. You can go and listen to a couple of them if you want to get a taste for it. And also, you get to watch all the episodes over there. I release the videos of all of these chats. So if you'd like to watch your pods, then head over to patreon.com off the beat and track. It's beat and, not beaten. And your one-stop shop for all of these things is the website, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Right, let's get on with the good stuff. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beat and Track Podcast with the delightful Sarah Jane Morris.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Sarah Jane Morris, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. There's a bit of a slight blue sky amongst the clouds here in London.
Lovely, lovely. Well, we was talking a moment ago before we press record, and you was talking about home in St Leonard's, which is a beautiful part of the world. And you mentioned that it was a good place to be during the sort of the lockdown time. So before we get onto your playlist, talk me through how you found those times, both personally and creatively.
Okay, it ended up, we literally moved house the summer, at the end of the summer before COVID. So we were just sort of settling in. We took on a converted shop. It had originally been a pub, and it was a shop, and it was on a street corner, right bang in the middle of St Leonard's, two roads down to the sea. And so being near the sea, I became a cold water swimmer, which really helped and meant that I met a wonderful group of people, which made us feel very much part of the community very, very quickly. But also that cold water swimming made me feel very alive, and it helped me through because I was someone that had been booked in for a knee replacement. And of course, COVID stopped that.
Sure.
So I had to try and carry on being fit, but without doing too much walking. And creatively, I was in a house that needed me to make my mark on it. But also I had a lot of time on my hand. I don't have a television, haven't had a television for 14 years. So my husband and I, we read to each other a great deal. And I did both things. I did decorating of the house, which I've done in quite a creative way. I'm a lover of the painter Vuillard, which is all about different textiles and clashing of patterns, and as how I dress, and it's how I decorate. So I got very involved with that, having to buy everything on eBay and Facebook Marketplace and such. Sure. Like. But it was a great test. But creatively, because I don't have a television and because we read to each other a lot, my husband and I said to each other, we have two sofas opposite each other, why don't we find, well, it was my idea, why don't I find out about the lives of 10 female singer-songwriters that I feel changed musical history? They're obviously my choice, not everybody else's choice, but they were an interesting choice. And I chose Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, Nina Simone, Miriam McCabe, Aretha Franklin, Janis Joplin, Joni Mitchell, Ricky Lee Jones, Annie Lennox and Kate Bush, all of them very, very different. But what I did was I bought off Amazon, I bought biographies, autobiographies, went onto YouTube, watched any footage of any documentary, listened to any music that I could get hold of each of those singers, and really absorbed myself in their lives for that long period of time. And I fell in love with their journeys. I already loved their music, but all of their journeys were fascinating. And a lot of them really did change political history, not just musical history. Yeah. And so I wrote their life stories. And then my co-writer, Tony Remy, who played in Annie Lennox's band for many years when she went solo, it was at a point where we could be 3 meters apart. So we measured the 3 meters. The sofa was 3 meters apart. My brother, who's a filmmaker, was behind a chair 3 meters apart. And I read all of these lyrics to Tony. He'd come down. He'd learned how to use Logic recording on his computer in the first lockdown. And he what he did was he brought his laptop with Logic on. He bought his guitar, his acoustic guitar, and he bought a MIDI keyboard. I bought a decent microphone. So I was sitting the other side with my microphone because I did a lot of virtual concerts because my son, his business went down the pan just before COVID. He moved home. He's a singer-songwriter. So he and I did these virtual concerts all the way through lockdown. So I'd got a decent mic And I read these lyrics to Tony to give him an idea about what I'd found out about these amazing singers. And we both at the same time said, why don't we write the music in the genre of the singer? So that the Joni Mitchell song sounds like a Joni Mitchell song, but it's about her life and so on. And that was when we got really excited. And we thought, God, this will call on everything we have ever learned. We have both been in South African township bands. We've been in Latin bands, in classical, folk, rock, pop. We had all of that to call on at our fingertips. And we wrote each song, obviously we fine-tuned it all, but we wrote each song within an hour. And because we knew what to do. It was a language we understood. And it got us through lockdown, and it became this ongoing project, which I'm sure is going to take up the next several years of my life. It's already now taken up 2.5 years, but I had to then, because Brexit came along, most of my career's in Europe, that destroyed my career. COVID then came along, meant no concerts. I didn't have in my bank account what I normally keep. I normally keep aside 50% of everything I earn to make the next album, because I run my own label. I do it all myself. I hadn't got that. So I then had to think so outside the box as to how to fund the album. And that became creative writing courses in my home where people came to stay. And my husband did the cooking, fine art programs, where weekends where people came to learn to draw and paint that he taught because he's an artist. I did vocal masterclasses where people came for an entire weekend, about 20 people. And then I taught them my backing vocals. So they came and sung at Ronnie Scott's with me. I did bartering sessions with Guy Chambers where I did vocals for him and he let me have a couple of days in his studio. Somebody gave me a sewing machine in lockdown. I learned how to use it and I made cushion covers, tablecloths, sold them on Marketplace and eBay. My friend Wendy May, the wonderful DJ who lives down here, anything I couldn't do that was more complicated, like curtains and things, she made. And all of those things have paid for this album to be completed. And it's been the most amazing creative period. And it came out of that lockdown where you suddenly had the time to think in a different way.
Sarah, that's remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. I mean, I've asked this question maybe 300-400 times to guests, certainly during the lockdown. Nobody has ever answered it so fantastically, and just, you know, I often speak about, you know, when the things that you need are taken away from you in creatively, that, you know, the punk in you comes out and you go DIY, right, what can I do here, what have I got at my disposal? Yeah. And it's gonna, you know, be that sort of punk approach as to, like, this is what I've got, what can I do? I mean, yeah. You've took that and you've run with it. It's like, I mean, the thing that I've just took from that is, right, I'm gonna throw my telly away when I get in tonight. Like, and the fact that you and your husband sit on opposite sofas and read to each other, that's beautiful. I love that.
It is a lovely thing. And the reason why I decided to try and do this project with Mark was the Christmas that went before that second lockdown, because we hadn't earned any money for such a long time. Christmas presents to anybody, including each other, was out of the question. So what we decided was we'd write each other a poem. His poem to me was so beautiful. I remember thinking, oh my God, you're a great writer. So I said to him, if you could only write another couple of verses, I'm going to turn that into a song. And I did. And that was the beginning of us sort of creatively combining our talents.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, look, let's we're talking songs. Let's start your playlist today. And I'm going to ask you, Sarah, for track one, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, I grew up in the 70s. That's my teen years. It was the best decade for music. You know, you had everything from Captain Beefheart to Sly and the Family Stone to Frank Zappa to the Bee Gees to Tamla Motown to Stax. You know, it was all there. And I've called on all of that in this project too, you know, everything that I listened to at that point. But I was hugely hugely influenced by, you know, that whole soul period. I was a Northern soul girl myself, you know, and I was one of those people doing backflips up at the Wigan Casino.
Oh, fantastic.
Telling my mum that I'd gone to my friend Lorraine's and her telling her mum she'd gone to mine. And we were on a bus up to Wigan, you know. But this particular song that I've chosen is not only because it's got this fantastic introduction, but because lyrically it means something to me. Because when I was 17 years old, I come from a big family. I've got six brothers. My dad went to prison. And it split up the family. We lost our home. You know, it changed our lives forever. You know, everything goes back to then when we had to reinvent ourselves. And I was even talking with my brother yesterday, who's part of my project. He does all the filming side of things. And we were talking to somebody else that I was filming as part of my project and saying, we both said that our life changed when Dad went to prison. And a lot of that is because also you as the child of that, and it's a lot to do with the way you're treated at school, you know, how teachers aren't there to support you as this family that's crumbling, was that you carry the guilt. You, the child, carry that guilt, you know. And I was saying that for me, one of the biggest insults anyone could pay me was to make out that I was ripping them off. And it all goes back to that thing of the father that had been in prison. You know, it's like, oh, God, well, that's you, isn't it? And it stays with you. And this song, the song that I've chosen that has the best intro, is Papa Was a Rolling Stone by The Temptations. And it's that man that I recognise as being my dad.
That's fantastic. And what an intro that is as well. The strings on that are quite sort of claustrophobic, aren't they? It kind of,
yes.
it really sort of crawls all over you as that starts to kind of open up.
And it
up.
Just gradually builds up one by one by one, you know. Yeah. Extraordinary.
And that was such a sort of an exciting time for Motown, and probably much against Berry Gordy's kind of vision, really, because I think, you know, when you started to see what the Temptations were doing and obviously famously what Marvin Gaye was doing with What's Going On, I think Berry Gordy was like, no, this ain't what it's about. This is not what Motown's about. We're a, you know, this kind of incredible pop machine.
We don't want your social comment.
We don't want social comment. We don't want this psychedelic nonsense. But
you know,
they go on to be some of the most iconic records, and certainly What's Going On, the biggest selling record in the history of Motown. And
absolutely,
yeah, glorious, glorious. Okay, I'm going to ask you now for track two to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, Sarah.
Well, I can remember getting my one of those tiny little plastic record players, you know, so anything that I could save up my I washed up in hotels to start with, then I did waitressing and I became a Silver Surface waitress. And in those days you could
where was this, Sarah, by the way, where was growing up?
Well, it was all over the place, because with a dad like that, it meant you were often moving in the middle of the night to dodge the official receivers coming to get your furniture the next morning. So our life was, I went to 13 schools, and this move in St. Leonard's was my 37th move. So a lot of that moving happened in my childhood, and I wasn't expelled from any school, but we were constantly moving. You know, we were renters. There was no money. We were a big family. And he lived his life balanced on that knife edge, you know, of between right and wrong. And, you know, we thought he was God, but it was very disrupting. And luckily, because we're a big family, whenever we were starting a new school, there were often quite a few of us starting at the same time. So we could kind of meet up in the break times to kind of give each other support. But it was pretty tough. But so at this particular point where I would have heard this song and been moved by it, it was we were living in the Midlands, and the school that I was at, it was one of those schools that had an intake from an RAF and CAD. We were out of the area, but it was the best sort of comprehensive school in the area. So I think we spent most of our time, you know, constantly saying to the school secretary, no, we are moving into the area. And of course, never did.
Yeah.
But you know, found our way of getting to school. And in fact, the way we got to school, this is an interesting story. So my mum, when I was 14, mum had the last baby. And she was having her baby in the hospital in Leamington Spa. And the school bus went all the way to Leamington, and everybody had been dropped off, half an hour before. It's just happened. That's where the depot was. And so I caught the school bus all the way back because I wanted to see mum every day that she was in hospital before she had the baby. And I got talking. They were lovely old guys. One, they're probably not old. They're probably my age, actually. But then it seemed like they were old guys. One driving and one was the conductor. And we must have got talking, and I told them about how mum was having a baby. And they said, do you know what? We drive past your house every morning. We could pick you all up. This was totally illegal. But they did. From then on, they stopped outside. This is a double-decker bus. It stopped outside our bus. And sometimes some of us weren't even dressed. And mum would bring toast out and a cup of tea to them to kind of apologise for the fact that we weren't all in uniform. That was how we went to secondary school, was through these brilliant men. And mum every year gave them a good birthday present and Christmas present. But it was totally illegal what they were doing. But that's how we managed to keep up this pretence of living in the area.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But anyway, the song that I chose was, and I ended up by writing songs with this wonderful man when I signed my first record deal. But his voice and the fact that he was using a ukulele and what he was singing about was just so gentle and beautiful. I was moved. It Must Be Love by Lavi Sifri, which later on became a hit for Madness.
Yeah.
But it was his version that touched me. And then when I signed to Jive Records for my first solo deal, they teamed me up with him, and I went and stayed with him in Wales with him and his husband, and did some co-writing with him. And it was a very lovely experience. He's a beautiful human being.
Oh, what a voice he has as well.
Yeah. And he's written some very important songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to ask, before we get on to the song that reminds you of school, the way that you described your upbringing and your dad's kind of sort of brushes with the law and such, like, you know, it sounds like, you know, as an outsider looking in, that, you know, if that was made into a film, it would be a kind of almost like a sort of kitchen sink black comedy, you know. But I imagine the actual realities of it, of going to, was it 13 different schools?
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty disruptive. And tell me how that sort of impacted on you as a person. And also, you know, because I mean, we've been speaking for 20 minutes now, and I've never met you before, and you come across with such confidence and such charisma. Is that confidence something that come from having to put yourself out there when you know you're going to these different schools, you know, time and time again, surrounded by strangers, having to go, got to do this again now, and you know, having to sort of hold your own and get stuck in. Tell me a little bit about them times and how that took it, sort of, you know, how that was for you.
It was terrifying. You know, that first day at a new school is utterly terrifying. I did have, you know, I had red hair, I had a big mouth, you know, all those sort of obvious things to tease someone about, you know. I would blush very, very easily. Had freckles, that was also considered not a great thing. So all of those things I was carrying with me. And I knew that I came from this very unconventional home. You know, I mean, our, like, for instance, our transport, Dad We didn't have a normal car. Dad bought a job lot of bubble cars from a garage. They hadn't, it hadn't worked as an idea. So we were, we as kids were illegally driving these bubble cars. We had Fankels and Messerschmitts. We had one each. Okay.
I mean, this has got to be turned into a film. This is absolute crackers.
And this is how mad he was. Okay, so he had one. He had a Heinkel, and they look like an egg that opens up. And at Easter, what he did was he wrapped a crepe bow around it so that it was a bloody Easter egg that we would be getting out of, you know. And there was one. We lived quite a long way at this point when he had these bubble cars. We lived quite a long way from where you'd catch a bus. So you had to walk for an hour and a half, a mile and a half before you got the bus. And sometimes we were flooded in the village. And so, you know, he'd be trying to get you to the bus so that you didn't have, you know, because you couldn't cross. So you'd be floating over this sort of river. Then it would get back out. And then he'd chase the bus down the main road, get up onto the pavement. The bus would stop at the bus stop and he'd open the egg and you'd get out of the egg onto the bus. Now, you try living that down.
Impossible.
It was things like that that were really, really embarrassing, you know. And we were always the family that, because his timekeeping was bad, you'd go off on a school excursion or there'd be something happening at school and you'd be there 2 hours after everybody had gone home, and one poor teacher had to stay and wait, you know, while your dad then arrived in the bubble car. And, you know, that was the story of our life. I don't know how this happened, but at one point he managed to convince some company to, I think this was a shared job where he shared the use of a helicopter. Okay. We're talking, we had no money. So this is all done he sounded like he could be the lord of the manor. He came from a rich family originally. So he had the confidence that goes with public school or whatever that is, you know. So he could walk into the store, that's how we furnished our places. He would walk into a new furniture store and get all the furniture on HP. He'd never pay a single month, but then that's why the furniture there would then be taken away. But he had that confidence and that voice, and everybody thought, you know, oh, of course he must be terribly wealthy. Of course we'll do this, you know. And that worked for him, but it also worked against him because eventually he did go to prison.
Yeah.
But he managed to, for a short period of time, share this helicopter with someone. And there was one, this was the time that I don't think we ever really got over this one. Okay. So he was supposed to be picking us up to take us to the dentist. So this is during school time.
Yeah.
And from then on, we never, ever met it. We would always walk for about a mile away from the school if we ever had to be met with him after this. Without permission, he landed his helicopter in the middle of a game of rugby to pick us up. Can you imagine?
Doesn't bear thinking about. Oh,
we're
my
in a
God.
Normal comprehensive school.
How the hell
we're
did you get through school?
To fit in.
Oh my God.
That we had no money. We didn't live in a house that was owned, but he managed to pull that off.
That's insane. I mean, let's talk school. tell me the track that reminds you of those times, which sounds okay. Surreal.
So one of the schools that I landed in year three in secondary school was this Kyneton High School. And this song had just come out. And I just thought that this singer was just so amazing. I loved it, the way he was. It was very gender fluid now. We know that as a term now. I didn't know it then. And it was just so out there and so different to anything else I'd ever heard. And what I did was I wrote in my best handwriting, because I won an All England handwriting competition, okay, for platinum pens the year before. So I'd got this beautiful platinum pen, and I wrote in my best handwriting the lyrics of this out for every single member of my class. And I suppose it was possibly my way of trying to say hello to everyone and fit in. It was Life on Mars by David Bowie.
Oh, that'd do it, wouldn't it? Oh, what a record.
What a record.
And, I mean, tell me that the sort of impact that, you know, seeing Bowie at that point on Top of the Pops and things like that. Tell me about, you know, how that impacted on someone, you know, in the sort of formative years.
Well, I loved how he dressed. You see, I've always loved costume. And I loved his look. And what I loved about that first period of his career was you know, the fact that he created this character. In a way, someone else that I love the music of, Tom Waits, he created a character very early on that he stayed with. And, you know, he made that go on for a lot longer than Bowie did Ziggy. But he was extraordinary looking. Beautiful and handsome, both beautiful and handsome. Yeah. That, like I was saying before, that gender fluidity, which, you know, later I explored in the songs that I wrote about Annie Lennox and about Kate Bush. They both, you can tell that they were influenced by Bowie too.
Yeah.
In how they did their videos and how they presented themselves, you know, and also with the whole mime thing that he very much got into. He was an extraordinary person that couldn't be categorized, and I loved the fact that you couldn't categorize him.
Absolutely.
I went to see him in concert just to that point that he was he went off to America and he came back and he killed Ziggy, and I went to this concert and everybody had come dressed as Ziggy, and he was in a very different costume and a very different period of his music, and the audience didn't know quite what to do. Probably a bit like when Dylan killed acoustic and went electric. It's like that. There was an audience that didn't know what to do with this. They knew it was something amazing, but they weren't quite there.
Yeah.
And
Sarah, in regards to school, did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No, absolutely not. So I was also talking to a friend about this the other day, because, you know, you're given, you know, the odd half hour where you talk about what could be a career afterwards.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
For me, you know, all I was told I could be was an air stewardess or a policewoman. You know, that was what was being presented to me in those talks about what to do at school. And I never did music at school. Whichever school I went to, it was always you could choose between art or music or another subject that I really needed to do. So I always did art, you know, ceramics and graphics. And I mean, that I thought I was going to be going to art school.
Yeah,
that was what I was going to be doing until, you know, I'm halfway through my A-levels and Dad goes to prison. And I had a breakdown. This is very, very bad headship, but we had a head teacher, a woman head teacher at this point. I think years later it came out in the press that there were many backstories to this woman, but at this point that she was the head teacher. And so we'd lost our home, and Mum was a secretary in a school, and she must have broken down in the common room. And it was the religious education teacher that came to her aid and said, look, the church owns the schoolhouse. I think that's free. It's only two bedrooms, but it's going to be somewhere. So we were living on church charity in this little schoolhouse. Okay. And Mum had to work over, because Dad had made us all directors of one of these companies. That was one of the things that took him to prison. We were all underage. So the only way Mum could stop the social services taking us all away, because we were all under 18, was to make us wards of court. So that, you know, she had a really difficult time, and she'd got a tiny baby. Okay. So she started doing this new, an evening class at the local college, and it was called T-Line. So it was a new form of shorthand, because she'd been very, very good at other shorthands. And so she'd done two sessions, and they'd had so much demand for this new T-Line that they were having to create new lessons for it. And they said to her, look, you're so good at this. I know you've only done two sessions, but is there any way that you carry on coming and learning, but you are teaching what you've just learnt, because we think you could be a great teacher? She couldn't turn that down, because how else was she going to feed, you know, all of these kids and the baby? So I had to be that person that would come home from school straight away and look after the baby brother, so that she could go. At this point, I think Tom was three years old. So that she could go off to do her evening class and then teach. So I went in a sixth form privilege at this comprehensive was what you could choose all sorts of things. And I had chosen sailing. You know, when was I ever going to learn to sail otherwise? So, but it was quite a long way away from the school, and you had to go off on a coach. I knew I couldn't do that. So I went to the head teacher and I said, look, Miss Barnes, I have to go home. I have to look after my brother because Mum has to go and teach. She said, no, this is a sixth form privilege. You have to do it. So she knew I would hide because I had to go and do that.
Yeah.
But what a horrible thing for her to have done. So I went and hid in the common room because I knew I had to get on the bus. She came and found me there. The next day, she said to, you know, in assembly, we have a liar and a cheat in our midst. And she made me stand up. Okay. I had a breakdown. I thought I felt I was being blamed for my father, for everything. I didn't ever go back to school. And I thought everybody was talking about me. My poor mum, she was already having to deal with in the local shop where she could buy food, where you paid at the end of the month on tick, you know, on tap. She was already knowing that every time she went into the village shop, people stopped talking. It was obviously they were talking about her, our family. We were that family. And so I had to rethink, you know, what the hell was I going to do? And I think it was probably about 3 or 4 months, I realized I had to continue my education. And this is where it all changed for me. The local college was Stratford-on-Avon. You either went to Leamington or Stratford. And it was the day where you have to sign up for a course. So I went in on the bus. But I was still, if somebody so much as looked at me, I was still doing that terrible blushing. You know, I was still carrying all of this guilt from Dad and the breakdown and everything. And I didn't have the confidence to go in and sign on. I didn't know what I was going to sign on to, but I knew I had to go in and be part of some kind of education. So I went round to the back of the building to try to, you know, to breathe, calm down. And there was a guy leaning against the wall, about the age of my father, smoking a cigarette. And he said, hello, what are you doing? And I explained that I was trying to calm down. He was nice to me. I told him my life story. And he said, you're supposed to come here. This behind me, this is the drama studio. I run the drama department. It turned out he was the leading authority on Bertolt Brecht in the country. He had set up the first theatre and education college course, which was this. And he said, you have been alienated. Brecht is all about alienation. You need to be doing this course. I never had to go round and sign on. He took me under his wing, and he became like that. He became like a father figure. And he was my introduction to socialism. And I was able to express myself and help to write plays. I was in Ben Elton's first ever production. He was the year above me. Ben Elton was on this course.
Wow.
And I was in his first play. And I was able to write a song about being an outsider, which was how I felt. And it's how I felt my entire journey. But I've learned how to think, realize it's a good thing to be an outsider, to not tick all the boxes.
They're the interesting ones.
Yeah, I now wear it as it's something to be proud of.
Absolutely. Not many people have got a story like what you've just said. So you talk about confidence and you know, and the struggles that you might have had, and feeling sort of, you know, like the people around were judging you and such. And my introduction to Sarah Jane Morris would have been when I was probably 14, 15, and it would have been, you know, seeing you on the television. And that looked like a very confident person to me at that point. Tell me a little bit about, I mean, we've also mentioned the impact of seeing Bowie on Top of the Pops and that. I'm always interested, like, did you get to do Top of the Pops at that point?
So I got to, when I was in the Communards, we were number one for, I think it was 8 weeks. So we got to be on Top of the Pops 4 times. And like you said, when you're watching, you know, as a young person watching it, Top of the Pops looks huge, doesn't it? It looks like there are so many stages. I remember being really shocked, suddenly finding myself in not a very big room with only a couple of stages. And also at the point that Jimmy and Richard and I were doing Top of the Pops, I'm sure it changed lots of different points you had where people played live.
That's right.
But we at our point, you were miming.
Mm.
Jimmy and I could really sing.
Mm.
And we found this quite frustrating. You know, just we got quite good at doing the miming to our own parts. But by at this point, I think we'd been at number one for about 6 weeks. And I don't think we really even said anything about it. We just were a bit bored by being trapped like this. And so I mimed to Jimmy's part and he mimed to mine. And we were called up over the coals. We were pulled up to the director's office and told that had we not been at number one, we would have been pulled and never come back on.
Fantastic.
You know, you know, we really were reprimanded, you know, but I think we wanted to make a point of, hey, this is not for real.
I'm going to pick back up on Top of the Pops because it's something that, you know, so many of us, it's had such a huge impact on so many of us on so many different levels. And I will pick back up on that. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask you for your fourth track, Sarah, which is the first record you bought from a record store.
Yeah, so the first single that I'd saved up my chambermaiding money from was the fantastic Rocket Man by Elton John.
Oh, what a record.
And what a record indeed. And I loved, I do remember years later, Kate Bush did a great cover
of that. She did, didn't she?
And I loved her version of it. It was fantastic.
It almost had a sort of like a reggae undertow, if I remember rightly, Kate Bush's version. Yeah. It had that kind of sort of skank to it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, she comes from the same school as me. It's very rare that she's ever covered a song because she writes all of her stuff. But you don't cover a song unless you change it and you claim it and you make it your own.
Well, you mentioned some of the artists that you've been studying. And when you mentioned Annie Lennox, it was only about a year ago in lockdown, I was recording little radio shows to keep myself sane during lockdown. And I stumbled across the original of No More I Love Yous, which I didn't realise was a cover. And I absolutely love the original. I think it's a fantastic piece of kind of late 80s sort of pop production. And then I've done a bit of a dive on them because I was like, okay, what's the deal? And I believe that they supported the Eurythmics. If I'm right, you're probably the expert on this. And then I presume through that time that Annie must have obviously heard that song. And then...
Oh, wow. I don't know the history of that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Wow.
But
wow.
Yeah, because I was like, because it's not on Spotify. What is it? It's A Lover Speaks, I think, is the name of the artist that
yes, done it first. Yes, 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 yes.
And yeah, then I was like, so why have I never heard of them? I'm a real nerd for music. And yeah, they did support Eurythmics. And I was like, that's where Annie's heard that track. And then I think years later, he was a songwriter as well. And I don't know if they worked together, but yeah, she must have used that track from remembering it from when they
But I mean,
together.
What an extraordinary voice and songwriter she is. And one of the things in the song that I've written about her that I really wanted to show was what a pioneer she's been and how she's carried on fighting for women's rights. She is that, you know, human rights spokesperson. You know, she Mexican. Is she puts her money where her mouth is, and I think she's an extraordinary woman. I've only met her. I met her very, very early on when she... In fact, I met her a couple of times, once at an airport, because we were both going off doing various TVs. And but the first time was... It was when they just closed down the Tourists and set up the Eurythmics, and they just got their studio. And I don't know whether I even owned it at this point. And I was with a friend of mine called Mitch Binns. He had written a three-hander based on the scandalous book Hollywood Babylon. And he'd called it Hollywood Dreams. And he'd written as a three-hander musical to go to the Edinburgh Festival. I was one of the three. And he played Marilyn Monroe and Marlene Dietrich. You know, he liked being in the dress. And he got a good pair of legs as well, and a great voice. And I played, what did I play? I played Fatty Arbuckle. I played Francis Farmer. I played Hedda Hopper. But anyway, it was a great piece. And we were just, it was singing in a wine bar in Chalk Farm. And they both came in. And of course, we knew them from Top of the Pops, from the Tourists. They sat at the bar and had a cocktail. And they got talking to Mitch particularly. And said that they needed some backing vocals, but they didn't have any money. And so a bartering was done where backing vocals were done for a track in lieu of a day in their studio to record the musical before we went to the Edinburgh Festival. Wow. And Dave was the engineer, and he was very, very friendly and lovely. But and then my guitarist, Tony, was in her band for many years, and he said that she was the most fantastic band leader because she was part of their education. He said that when they all went to South Africa, because obviously she became friends with Nelson Mandela, you know, she's that kind of person. And they went out to do the Nelson Mandela concert in South Africa. And she made sure the entire band came with her to a hospital full of AIDS patients. Amazing. And understood how all of that worked, and she set up her charity Sing, which is about educating women in South Africa as to how to protect themselves in a climate that where HIV is huge, you know. So I just think that she's a remarkable woman, And
it's important, Sarah, that these artists, certainly women as well, that are speaking out in an industry where you're encouraged to toe the line, shush, you do what you do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're only seeing now and people are now applauding Sinead O'Connor for how outspoken she was and how she done, you know, she spoke out and kicked back against things at the time, you know, absolutely. Yeah. They ruined her, you know.
And they absolutely did. And she was one of the sisters. She was one of the people I was going to write about. And I remember thinking, she's so she's balanced on an edge. I don't want to be responsible for pushing her over the edge.
Yeah.
If I wrote, because I've only ever written anything that's totally respectful to any of these singers, but I didn't know quite what place she was at, but I knew she was fragile.
Yeah.
And so I chose not to write it, but I have actually now written her song.
Oh, fantastic.
But I met her. It was a fantastic concert. It was called What Women Want. It was organised by Lynn Franks, the PR guru, and Janet Street Porter was linked with it and was filming it. And it was Zap Mama, it was Sinead, it was Chrissie Hynde, myself, all sorts of wonderful people. And there was a press conference for this. And so there's this photograph with Glynis Kinnock, Chrissie Hynde, Sinead, myself, and Lynn Franks. I had a three-month-old baby, Otis. He was in my arms for this photo session. And Sinead suddenly said, "Oh, I'm so Brody, please can I hold him?" So she held him. And do you know what? All of the photographs that went around were Sinead holding my son, saying this was her love child.
Wonderful.
So Otis loves this, you know, the fact that people think that Sinead is his mum. But it was quite disturbing at the time for me because it was my only child.
Yeah.
I was only 3 months into it and suddenly it was in the Times and you name it. A Sinead's love, you know, sort of secret child.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Okay.
But yeah, I think she was incredibly brave. She was telling the truth. It was proved all those years later that there was such terrible sexual corruption within the church.
Absolutely.
She was incredibly honest about her struggling with her mental health issues, and she did bring it to the fore. And I think she also her voice is extraordinary. I think everything she's ever sung has been so powerful yet so gentle.
Yeah.
She's able to put both of those things into a piece.
Absolutely.
And you know, I loved the album that she did with Christy Moore.
Yeah.
You know, and the song that I've written about her is like a beautiful Irish lament.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. Right, track five. Let's go clubbing. Tell me the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing, please, Sarah.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer.
Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Like I said, I was a Northern Soul girl, and Lorraine and I lied to our parents and got on a bus and were continually going to the Wiggins Casino, and we learned how to backflip. We did it all on water. We weren't, you know, using anything, but we loved to dance all night, and we learned to do that kind of side shuffle. And one of the songs that I remember dancing to the most during that period, I'll tell you a bit more. So also, where we lived, there was a club called The Globe in Warwick, mm-hmm. which was open on a Sunday night that played Motown, Stax, you know, black music, which was what we were far more interested in than anything. And so every Sunday night we were at The Globe, but as often as we were able to, we were up at the Wigan Casino. And there was also a place called Chesford Grange that we used to go to and dance around our handbags. And this song, My Man is a Sweet Man by Millie Jackson, was one of those songs. That years later, I went to see Millie Jackson at the Odeon, and she was so utterly outrageous. It was like that. There's no one else out there that such wonderful filth comes out of the mouth of. But as many words as Bobby Womack uses in his songs, it's a woman being sexual, and I hadn't heard that before, you know, except for Bessie Smith and her blues and her claiming her sexuality. Yes. I hadn't really heard it in the same way as Millie Jackson, and it was like, wow, this is just fantastic.
Absolutely, absolutely. I remember being, I think I was probably about 14 or 15, and seeing the cover of Back to the Shit, and just thinking, oh my God, who's this Millie Jackson? This is wild. And like,
yeah.
And obviously, you know, when you're young and you're kind of finding your way, you're always drawn to the stuff that's a bit more kind of exciting, dangerous. And yeah, I think Millie Jackson represented that perfectly.
Absolutely. She's just claiming it all. Don't mess with me.
Absolutely. Well, tell me a little bit, just sort of, you know, being a number one for the amount of time that you was, how did it go from, you know, being a musician that had a, you know, a good career to being a super recognisable face in a period of weeks, like from being on, you know, when you're in somebody's front room every Thursday night and you're at number one, like how did you deal with that?
It was a very odd transition because everything I'd done up until that point was being part of I was with The Republic, which was an African Caribbean Latin band before you used the word, well, you know, world music.
Yeah.
Or the term world music. And we were signed to Charlie Gillett's label. And Charlie Gillett was a fantastic radio DJ, but he kind of wrote many interesting books, but he signed Lena Lovitch. I think he had Ian Dury. You know, people came and stole his artists. Yeah. You know, Stiff was forever taking, you know, whoever Charlie had signed. But he was very much behind that whole world music scene. And so our first single was Anti the Malvinas War. And our second one was The Royal Family. And so we were, you know, we were the band that was supposed to happen. We were the cover of the NME. We were the cover of City Limits. Granada TV did a documentary about us. We were too political in the time of Thatcher's Britain. So that just didn't happen. We didn't get radio play. That split up and it became two groups. It became Three Mustafas Three, which was a fantastic band, and The Happy End, which was a 25-piece political big band where we did music, political music from all over the world. It was a mixture of men and women, some who'd only just bought their instrument. So it was, you know, some people could play very, very well, and some people were just learning, but it was giving people the opportunity. And that was amazing because in that period, you knew that your audience were people you wanted to know. It was so right on. And we, at that point, during the miners' strike, we then collaborated with a Kent miner's wife called Kay Sutcliffe, who'd written these fantastic lyrics, and we then recorded it and arranged it, and it became the anthem of the miners' strike, Coal Not Dole. And it was at that point that Jimmy and I were connected, and we were connected through Richard Coles, who was my brother, the filmmaker, Rod Morris's friend, at the same drama college I'd gone to. 4 years later, they were both there and became friends. And Richard used to bring, you know, come along to my concerts with the Happy End, with the Republic. He joined the tail end of Bronski Beat with Jimmy, and then they formed the Communards.
Which, now, Jimmy and Bronski Beat were doing the benefit, the miners, gigs,
yeah,
for the miners.
And you see, yeah, and Jimmy's best friend was Mark Ashton, who was the person they made that film, The Pride.
That's right.
And he was also part of our political education. You know, he was so out there. You know, we thought we were already political, nothing compared to him. And he came out to America with us when we recorded that first Communards album. And he was just so inspirational, Mark Ashton. And so he got Jimmy involved in all of that. And Richard brought Jimmy along to see me at one of these benefits. And I, of course, knew him through Bronski Beat. You know, he was very, very recognizable. But we were, you know, we got on instantly. And it was this thing of, you know, I'm this very tall, redheaded woman with a low voice. And he's a very petite, redheaded man with a terribly high voice.
Yeah.
And it was this wonderful role reversal. And we just immediately said, we must do something together. And they'd been asked to do a Gaze the Word benefit, bookshop benefit across the road in the brainwork, it's in Brixton, the wonderful big venue. It'll come back to
the
Academy.
Not
the Academy, that's back up into town. Anyway, it was across the road from where I lived, and that's so terrible that I can't think of its name at the moment. That's my age being given away. But anyway, it was across the road, so it was easy for me. But because it was way before mobile phones, and they were both busy, promoting You're My World, their first single. So I think I eventually managed to get hold of Jimmy. They were living together at this point with their manager up in West Hampstead. And I got through to them on the phone saying, you know, we were going to do a duet. It's kind of tomorrow, and any idea what we'll do? And of course, they hadn't had any time to think about it. And I said, I think I've got a good idea. What about we both sing Billie Holiday's Lover Man? So we're both arguing over the same man. It's very camp, and they loved the idea. So Richard tried to find the chords. I printed up the lyrics. So Jimmy and I on stage were kind of tearing them from each other. It was a totally gay audience. They just loved it. The record company was in the audience, could see that this was a winning combination.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'm asked to go off to America. So my whole life changed at that point anyway. So I'd never really earned money other than probably, you know, you split a fee between 25 musicians. You're lucky if you're going away with 20 quid each, you know. Then suddenly you're off to America to record an album. I didn't even know that the record company would buy my ticket. I was busy saving up, trying to save up for my flight. That's how out of touch I was with that other world. Okay. Then you come back. Then we did the Red Wedge tour. We tried it all out, just the three of us. That was a fantastic experience. Then the album comes out. You're suddenly earning money on a weekly basis, doing touring. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I can pay my rent. I can, you know, all of that stuff. But suddenly being on Top of the Pops and being in everyone's front room, I thought I would love it. I thought, yeah, this is, I want to be famous. But people start following you home on the tube. They imagine you've got money or somebody worth mugging, or you don't know if that person that's sitting opposite you on the train that started talking to you knows you. Do you actually know them? Or, you know, you lose track. You start to lose track of who you know and who you don't. And it was an odd thing. And then suddenly, you know, we were away for a year touring. I really missed home. And I watched how Jimmy had to constantly disguise himself when we were going out so he could have any kind of private life, you know, because he was so recognisable.
Of course.
And I remember thinking, I don't know that I want that for myself. I did go after that and sign a major deal with Jive, but I didn't sit comfortably with it. I supported Simply Red around Europe, you know, so I was playing to huge audiences. I was having hits in Europe with songs that were being banned in England. I did, you know, my first single, because I wasn't a writer at this point. My first single was a cover of Me and Mrs. Jones, the Billy Paul song. I didn't change it to Me and Mr. Jones because I didn't do that. And I'd had a number one hit with a gay band. Suddenly, Radio One has a problem. Maybe I'm a lesbian coming out of the closet 4 years before K.D. Lang gloriously comes out. Nobody, they're terrified of this. You know, the fact that I'm wearing Victorian underwear and a beauty spot and I might be a lesbian. Oh, my God. You know, so end of my career in England. You know, it was like suddenly I didn't exist. I'd been the darling of the left-wing press and the darling of the gay press. And suddenly I'm on my own and it looks like it's all over.
Wow.
And luckily, Simply Red asked me to support them at that point. So I go off. A lot of people think I'm his kid sister, the red hair. My music's jazzy soul. He was going through that period of being slightly jazzy too. They did that cover of If You Don't Know Me By Now. And in Italy, the press treated me like a double bill, not as a support act. And Me and Mrs. Jones went to number one. And that started my European career, where it stopped in England, it started elsewhere, which is why Brexit for me has just been not just devastating because of everything that it means, but it's meant that I have a third of the work that I had, and Europe's been so good to me.
Well, hopefully, I did hear some rumblings that there's got to be changes made. On the radio yesterday, funnily enough, regarding touring artists in Europe, because I think any artists, certainly, like, you know, I think they were sort of referencing, like, you know, new bands that haven't got, that are not privileged, that are working class bands.
How are they going to work that through?
It's impossible.
They're given the chance.
It's impossible. Yeah. And well, look, we're talking about Europe, and let's not open the Brexit can of worms because I'll just be ranting forever about that. Let's take you home, and for track six, I'm going to ask you for a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please, Sarah.
Okay, so at the moment, as you know, I've travelled all over the place, but at the moment, my home county is East Sussex, and there is a glorious singer-songwriter that lives in my community that I've known for years and years and years, because we've often been playing the same place. But there are a few singers that I listen to, particularly in a live performance, that move me to tears every single time. But this woman is extraordinary in our community, because she was born in Hastings. She is so loved there and so revered, and she is so genuine. And her version of this song, which she didn't write, but it's on an album of hers. It was written by a friend of hers. And this song moves me to tears. And I just think it's about, you know, it's about Hastings and the fact that I'm living at the seaside, but her voice and her interpretation of anything. I think like Stevie Wonder, I don't think she has ever sung a bum note in her life or an insincere note in her life. This is Leanne Carroll singing Seaside.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, well, look, I'm going to get on to your final track. And again, as you've just introduced us to a fantastic artist there, this is your chance to be an influencer as well and a tastemaker. And so for track seven, Sarah, can you tell me a song that you think many of my listeners may not know that you would like them to go and hear, please?
Absolutely. So this is a song by, you know, one of our greatest singer-songwriters still living. You know, some people love the whole package. Other people just love the songs that he's written rather than his voice. I've heard all sorts of different takes on this. My husband, Mark, is one of his biggest fans. And my husband was saw him at the De Montfort when he went from acoustic to electric. And he was quite young. And he and his friend, school friend, they were quite far back. And, you know, as part of the revolt of the folky followers of the acoustic, who all had obviously planned to leave at this point to make a point. And it meant that Mark and his friend got front seats suddenly.
Oh, result.
You know, they were moved down. So this is brilliant. But you know, Bob Dylan is a phenomenal songwriter. I've covered a couple of his songs along the way. One on my Bloody Rain album, where I did a duet with a fantastic Nigerian singer-songwriter, Keziah Jones, of I Shall Be Released. And it always spoke to me because of the lyrics of the song. It's about being released from prison. And I always thought of my dad,
yeah,
you know, being locked away. But then when I did an album with the fantastic Italian guitarist and composer Antonio Forcioni, and we did a cover of Blowing in the Wind, and a very broken down acoustic version of it. But this particular song, it's not one of his most famous, and in some ways it went under the radar. But, you know, I was thinking about dignity and respect. They're parts of the same thing. Respect. We hear Aretha singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T. You know, I demand your respect. Dignity is it's the same. You know, treat me with respect. Treat me with dignity. And in this song, Dylan reveals the difference. You know, we demand respect, but do we have dignity? What is dignity? It's elusive. It's imagined. It's hard to define. And somebody said that the dignity was the first to leave. And they showed me a picture and I just laughed. Those are lyrics in his song. Dignity never being photographed. You've got criminals, you've got vagabonds, you've got princes, you've got arsonists, all of these players in a piece where dignity is the concept which evades capture. It's like the Will of the Wisp. Very important song, Dignity by Bob Dylan.
Perfect. Well, Sarah, make it easy for people to go and check that if they haven't already, because we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all of the songs that we've spoken about today. And let's stop talking about other artists' music and let's talk about what's going to be happening in the coming months.
For me,
what's happening?
So I was telling you about this sisterhood project that I wrote during COVID. And I co-wrote it with my husband and Tony Remy. I spent the last year and a half crowdfunding it, and it started off being written in my new home. And I ran out of money along the way from all the different crowdfunding that I was doing. And so it ended up by being finally mixed in our front room too, you know, putting mattresses along the wall so that the next door neighbours were protected. And it's been the most fantastic project I've ever been part of. We have had so much love and support from everyone, and because it came from a good place, because it's about, you know, it's about the passing of the torch from one generation to another. We all know about the men; they're in the history books. Women rarely are, and even though my choice of 10 aren't everybody's choice, they are so important to me and to each other, you know. So one of the things that I discovered, you know, picture this, Bessie Smith, a black lesbian in the 20s. That in itself is like quite mind blowing. She put the blues on the map. She was the biggest selling recording artist, and she was selling to the black market, to the black community. That's where the money came from, that put Columbia Records on the map. Columbia Records would not exist without Bessie Smith. And Bessie Smith, she was literally busking on the street corner, age 9, both of her parents dead, to feed her brothers and sisters. She joined Ma Rainey's traveling circus in the vaudeville. She learnt her craft from Ma Rainey and Pa Rainey. but she became bigger than them. But she, because it was segregation, no matter how big she was, she still couldn't eat in a restaurant. She still couldn't stay in a hotel. So her way around that was to buy a Pullman train. So she traveled around America with her whole entourage on that train. But the Ku Klux Klan was shooting at that train as it passed by. That was her backdrop, you know. Came the Depression. This artist that had literally put blues on the map. Music changed. She made the way for Billie Holiday, for Lady Day. She passed the torch to her. But she died a pauper, Bessie Smith. She had to totally reinvent herself. She had to start driving to her concerts in her car with her musicians. She, a biscuit lorry drove into her car. It severed her arm. She married a guy who became her manager. He took all the money. She was in an unmarked grave. 33 years later, her cleaner, who had been a young girl at the time, heard that Janis Joplin had been talking about her biggest inspiration, Bessie Smith. So she went to Janis Joplin, or contacted Janis Joplin, and said that she knew where Bessie was laid, but there was no stone. Janis Joplin sent a check to pay for that gravestone. Janis Joplin died that year. They're all linked.
Of course.
They're all somehow linked. And so what I'm doing here is I'm 1 year younger than Kate Bush, and I'm seeing Kate as passing the torch to me, and I'm passing the torch on. That's what this project's about. It's big. There's a radio series I've written. I see it as a documentary, because I've documented every part of this through my brother. We set up a GoFundMe where people would pre-order the CD. And that gave us enough money to go to South Africa, where we would record the Soweto Gospel Choir on the song, because we'd written a big part in Khoza for Miriam Makeba. Huge part of my history, too, because Miriam Makeba, in the mid-80s, I joined Artists Against Apartheid. Jerry Dammers and Dali Tambo set this up. I knew Jerry because he was very involved with The Happy End. And of course, I knew him because of the specials. But he became a friend. And I with a megaphone and The Happy End, we were outside South Africa House most Fridays or Saturdays singing Sikelele Africa. I got pretty involved at this period of time. I was also through a wonderful South African pianist called Mervyn Africa, who had played with Hugh Masekela and with Miriam. He was living in Brixton near me. We started to write together. He convinced me to become a safe house for Black South African musicians that were arriving here that had nowhere to be through in exile. So he was another link. I became very much part of the African music scene at the 100 Club with Julian Bahula. I ended up with a Ghanaian band that I was in, that Eddie Reader was the other singer, by the way. We were called Fufu and Lightsuit. We supported Hugh Masekela. The guy that got me out of acting and into singing was a guy called John Machikiza. He was a Black South African actor. He was with the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, and that's how I knew him, because he was at Stratford when I was studying. He said he'd been asked with the Republic to write their lyrics, and he was a journalist as well as being an actor. And he said, look, can you come and be the singer? Because I know you can sing. And he said, I've got to go back and do another season with the RSC. So that got me involved. But his dad wrote King Kong, the musical, which is what brought Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba to London, first of all. Okay. So do you see all these links?
Of course.
Dali Tambo, who became a boyfriend of mine during this period, his dad was the head of the ANC the whole time that Nelson Mandela was in prison.
Wow.
So when I raised the money and thought, do you know what? I'm not going to send the files to the Soweto Gospel Choir like I had on my last album. I want to go and be there. I've never been to South Africa. I might never go. So my brother Rod, who was coming to film, and Tony and I went to South Africa. By the time the GoFundMe money came into my account, the flights had doubled. I didn't know how I was going to accommodate us. I tracked down Dali Tambo, having not seen him since 1987. And I had a conversation with him and his wife, and they've got four kids. They lived in Johannesburg. And he said, "You are my guests." So we flew to Tambo Airport, named after his dad, and we stayed with the Tambos. And he gave us his driver to take us to Soweto, where we recorded with the Soweto Gospel Choir on the day Miriam would have turned 90 years old had she lived.
That's remarkable.
We then did a pop-up concert in Cape Town, and I thought, well, I've never been, nobody's going to come, but an Italian fan of mine who had lived in Cape Town, who I've now since become great friends with, she's no longer the fan, she's the friend, but she had tried to book me to go to South Africa years before, and nothing came of it, and I didn't know what that was about, so I contacted her, and I said, what was your connection with Cape Town? And she said, my husband and I have a hotel here, but we've just sold it and we're on a safari. Why? And I said, well, I really want to go to Cape Town to film Mervyn Africa. But I don't have the money to pay for our accommodation and change the flights. And she said, leave it with me. And she got back to me the next day and she said, the people we've sold the hotel to, they're also Italian. They're big fans of yours. They're going to do you this really good deal. So it was a good deal. And I said, that's great, but I don't even have that money. Do you think we could do a pop-up concert? And she said, right, tell me what it is that you need. And I told her what we needed, and we'd have to hire a guitar for Tony and a PA and a place we could sell tickets and what do we do. And the next day she got back, and this is somebody who has nothing to do with the music industry. She got back to me the next day and she said, right, I found a venue. They don't normally charge on the door, but they're going to let me sell tickets. And she got me onto Cape Town Radio. She got me onto Cape Town TV. She sold out that concert to the Italian community in Cape Town. Who knew there was an Italian community in Cape Town? I've had so many hits in Italy that's what it's like. It's all this great karma around this project.
Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful story.
We're launching. We're actually not going to launch the album now for a while, but we are doing a world premiere of this project with an amazing lineup of musicians and an amazing lineup of actresses and singers. And it's at the Cadogan Hall, which is just near Sloane Square. It's a fantastic 950-seater venue. It's a multimedia project, so I've got film, and I've got you would even if you. Didn't know any if you even if you know about some of these artists, you will go away knowing so much more about their journeys and how important they are in our history. It's on the 6th of October at the Cadogan Hall, and we need to sell it out to be able to pay all of these people who have been part of it. It's the very beginning. This is like the first time we will ever perform this. And who knows where it will go from there. I'm hoping this has got many legs and it will fly. But even if it only happens at the Cadogan Hall on the 6th of October, it's going to be something that men and women are going to want to be part of. It's a very, very empowering project.
Sarah, the listeners to this podcast are all very passionate music fans, and I'm sure hearing your story today and hearing your enthusiasm and love for what you've put together, I guarantee you're going to be getting a lot of ticket sales off the back of this episode. And
well, that would be wonderful. If I know money's really tight, so it's not something you take for granted anymore that someone will buy the CD or someone can afford to come to a concert. But if people can, I promise you such an uplifting evening.
Wonderful. Sarah, it's been such a pleasure chatting to you today. Thank you so much for taking the time out to come on here.
Thank you for asking me on and for asking me all of those questions and wanting to know.
Absolutely.
It's a circle, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to press stop. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
Oh, mate, I love Sarah. How much fun was that? Honestly, I just think that was like that. Just a tiny little bit of a story. I mean, the project sounds absolutely incredible. You know that she's got stories for days. I need to get Sarah back on. I think once that the gig's out of the way and the record's out, We'll get her back on and we'll pick our brains even more because what a fantastic journey. Yeah, I hope you thoroughly enjoyed that episode. As I mentioned at the beginning, why not, if you want to go and watch it, head over to Patreon where you can watch that and all the other episodes and get access to hundreds of radio shows and unreleased episodes, playlists, mixtapes, and then swing by for a live show on Zoom. They're great fun. I guess that's all she wrote today. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'm not Beck. I wish I was Beck. I wish I had Beck's money. That said, he is one of them, isn't he? He's one of them, what do they call it? Yeah, he's up there with, he's a Scientologist, isn't he? No, I'm not Beck. I'm still Stu from Off the Beaten Track. I'm back next time. I'm not Beck next time. Have a lovely week. See you soon. Bye-bye.